All right, while we're changing the slide views here, let me introduce Dr. Stuart Harshberger, which I've had the pleasure of meeting in September, and about half hour into the breakfast realized that there was much too much that I wanted to learn from Stuart, and so made sure that we did have him back at this session today. Stuart is the program manager and a system integrator for the Defense Advanced Research Project, an agency-sponsored Revolutionizing Prosthetic 2009 program. And his team, himself and his teams, have been recognized with several awards and sponsor commendations for their efforts, including a 2007 Popular Mechanics Breakthrough Award, nomination for the DARPA Tech 2007 Award for Significant Technical Achievement, and nomination for a 2007 John Hopkins University Diversity Awareness Award. So I'm very pleased today to welcome here Stuart. Thank you, Stuart.
Okay, well, thank you very much for having me. Ross Anderson and I have worked together for a long time, and in fact, Ross was at Johns Hopkins, whether he cares to admit it or not publicly, for a period of time, and actually helped as co-PI start the framework program that I'm going to reference as sort of a case study in our practice and experience looking at what I'm going to be careful about the language and call indisciplinary collaboration, which I'll define on the next slide. But I think it fits very well into kind of the questions that are coming about as a result of, you know, this particular discussion forum today. So I'm going to couch this as my view of the subject and put it in kind of the experience today. And so what I say is N is if you look across the breadth of the broad view of disciplines and then down to this detailed research perspective, I would argue that it varies across the space of that domain and any time during the execution of a program. And so if you think about the kind of program that I'm going to tell you about, or a similarly complex challenge, then maybe at some point you're actually developing fundamental research that enables a new approach to a problem. Or maybe alternatively, you're doing more applied research or translation from research has been going on for decades into some usable practice and some measurable outcome. So it's potential that simultaneously you have traditional unidisciplinary research. At the same time, you may have people working together collaboratively who aren't really working in a transdisciplinary way, but there are people from different disciplines coming together to solve the problem, as I think has been more the model to date. And then there's this other domain, which we're going to refer to as cross-disciplinary, which involves people to work together in a much more collaborative way, sharing the same common framework of lexicon and communications, and also starting to try to view the problem at its grandest level from the perspective of their other colleagues so that you can bring together insights in a new way that hasn't really been done historically. So in any case, I think there are certain attributes of these kinds of programs that have to be consistent. And I think those questions that we would all have to ask ourselves is, what's in it for me? Okay. I think, you know, we can talk about collaboration, but Ross and I were visiting with a pretty prominent innovative and entrepreneurial in America and South in the United States, and he said, you know, collaboration's great, but nobody's going to collaborate unless there's something in it for both parties. And I think that's fundamentally a fact that we have to face. And so why as we bring these teams together, what can be a benefit to the individuals as well as the team towards the goal? I also believe that these kinds of efforts in this transdisciplinary, cross-disciplinary framework require some sort of initial spark and some sort of driving goal. So the program that I'm going to tell you about, I think, fits that, but I think, moreover, as we look to problems that can be solved in this manner, that those that initial spark and incentive has to be there. And I think for the team to be cohesive and actually produce something at the end where people are converging on a common set of goals, objectives, and outcomes, there has to be some compelling vision from the beginning. I think these are sort of the basic points of my message, If I don't get beyond this slide, this is sort of more or less it. The project I'm going to use as a case study is something called the Revolutionizing Prosthetics 2009 program. It's a four-year program that's funded by DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency in the U.S., to really address the level of injuries and be able to restore function to individuals returning primarily from the current conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan with upper extremity limb loss. And so the idea is to develop a fully neurally integrated limb system that actually is natural to control, that provides for some level of sensory feedback for a closed loop control, and responds in a way that it improves over the traditional methods with much more dexterity and degrees of movement. And so that's a pretty broad challenge that involves everything from mechanical and electrical engineering for the mechanical limb system itself to the neuroscience in terms of driving the signals from their inherent pathways in the body, to the kinds of advanced materials for cosmetic covering and the interaction with host tissue through the biology and so forth. So this will be kind of a broad framework in terms of bringing people from different disciplines together. The other problem is that it's a four-year program to develop a limb that's significantly beyond anything that exists, so it's a very compressed period of time. And bringing people together from different kinds of backgrounds doesn't provide necessarily the time for people to develop those working relationships before you get started on problem solutions. So that's another part of the issue. So just to kind of put it in a snapshot, because this talk's not about the program, and I have 300 or 400 slides also about that we could spend the afternoon on. But the idea is that this is a modular approach that allows a new limb to be fit to any different level of injury from the wrist all the way up to a full shoulder disarticulation case. The hand has about 15 to 20 degrees of dexterity alone, so the idea is it begins to approach that of the human hand. There are a range, and we've now had the opportunity to work with about 7 or 8 different patients, or collaborating partners I actually prefer, who have been testing these initial prototypes. So this whole set of progress is built on a series of iterative, aggressive prototype developments and quick clinical demonstrations and evaluations that continue to facilitate and drive not only the pathway towards the ultimate goal, but to reinforce the team momentum. And this is an important part, I think, along the way, that the team can see the progress that's being collectively made towards a common goal on a time frame that actually maps to what we desire. So, the program has been reported a fair amount in the media. We won some awards that Dr. Perot told you about. We also were on the cover for those in the engineering disciplines of the IEEE as a winner of 2009 in the January issue. We were on the front page of the New York Times a couple of weeks ago, and I was happy about that, but that article got picked up and became the front page story on the Hindu, which is the Indian national newspaper, which I thought was really kind of a testament to the cross-disciplinary and cross-cultural impact of this kind of a program. And so this is just a snapshot of some of the technology and scientific highlights from the first couple of years of the program. A lot of, again, iterative prototypes not only on the mechanical systems, but also on the neural systems that will allow us to get a better capability for driving control and actually begin to look at novel ways of providing sensory feedback that I believe in large measure are much more successful than people thought in the beginning. And I think even myself, I've been somewhat surprised by how well the team has worked together and how well we've been able to advance many of these issues as a collective body. So I'll start by saying we can't get to all of those pieces on that prior slide without the support and the momentum of a very broad, highly talented, and international team. I'll tell you a bit more about the team, but I should point out that a foundation of that starts on this campus. And so we have a lot of support from McGill looking at human factors and beginning to look at the translational pieces of what's necessary for education of the clinical community to understand how to use these new tools that will be necessary for deciding what neural interface would be appropriate and how to measure outcomes so that we can actually move towards a business model that will provide for payer reimbursement and those kinds of issues. And Dr. Anderson is leading a lot of that up for us, and I appreciate that. Beyond McGill, the program extends to about 30-some-odd additional institutions, small businesses, and corporations across 11 states in the U.S. and several countries in Europe and other provinces here in Canada, including the University of New Brunswick. And so it's not only geographically distributed, but it's also distributed in terms of, you know, the different disciplines, and also, I would say, most importantly, probably the different cultures involved. So, you know, I'm using my BlackBerry as a timer here, so I know where I stand. But, you know, also, you know, I have, really it's running as a 24/7 program. So I have people in multiple time zones. So I was saying last night at dinner that many of the people on our team are working, you know, 12 to 14, 16-hour shifts on a lot of days. And when we wrap up, we can fire problems off to, you know, our collaborators in Europe, and they have, you know, simulations and models and outcomes when we come back. And so we're really getting, you know, three times the work day out of every day. So instead of it being a four-year program, it really is a 12-year program, which is why I argue that we're making the progress along the pace that we are. But in any case, the issues there are things like, I got a burst of email last night about six different closure on six different topics from one of my colleagues. You know, he's up in the middle of the night thinking this through and sending me. The other idea is I ask, you know, for all of the cell phone numbers for several of our team members in another continent, and that's just unheard of. You know, it's like the work day starts and stops at a certain time, and you know, summer breaks are very rigid, and there are just certain different kind of cultural barriers that aren't obvious in the beginning that I think are maybe more important than some of the issues of distance and geography and so forth. So as I started putting together this team, Ross wanted to talk about how we collectively recruited these 30 different organizations to become a part of the solution set. I would say these are the two absolutely constant responses I would get when I would either call someone or I would travel to visit someone. You know, I would show up, and these are, as you see from this previous slide, some of the PIs that represent these institutions are well published and highly prominent people in their respective fields. In fact, the strategy was to reach out to the absolute best in the field and try to bring the experience that they had been putting together over their, you know, sort of unidisciplinary research over decades to bear on this problem. And so universally people would say, now, who are you exactly? Not only personally, which I can handle, but also, you know, why would someone from an engineering discipline be talking to me necessarily about, you know, a neuroscience application or a biological interface issue, et cetera. And then the other question was, okay, exactly why would we want to work in this kind of a framework, right? You're asking us to work with several of our colleagues who are, in fact, competitors for NIH funding and other kinds of, you know, peer-reviewed funding. And why would we, you know, kind of give up our unique niche in these funding competitive advantage for the funding resources to further this common goal? And so these were questions that we walked through, and I think this slide attempts to summarize this approach. We didn't let that stop us. I think, you know, you have to go out and you have to seek the best that you believe is the most suitable for the kind of problem you're solving once you break it down into all the required disciplines. And I think that has to extend regardless of your perception of them being interested in working on the problem or their geographic location or the culture. I think that you have to initially, as you meet with these individuals and begin to talk to them, you need to evaluate whether they actually really do need to work as part of the transdisciplinary, cross-disciplinary part of the team. There are lots of pieces of the team that still can be pursued independently and as a sort of unidisciplinary model, and that's a good thing. Not everyone can work in this kind of a model, nor is it necessary. And you also have to look at the person's commitment, both in time and, you know, how they feel about working as part of a team. And so I think that requires you to make some pretty harsh decisions up front, and that is, you know, sometimes it's better, I believe, to walk away from the most skilled, most talented person in exchange for someone who is talented in their own right but can work and part of the team construct in a much more favorable way. And that leads to some hard choices that I think you have to be able to make in order to preserve the integrity of the team over the long term. So wanted to talk a little bit about the balance between sort of discovery and engineering in this kind of a solutions-based, more of an applied model for the kinds of translational research that we're doing. And so one part of this is we have a four-year program that DARPA is very adamant about specific milestones. So there are very particular points along this path where we have to actually meet certain program objectives. And I won't get into the details of that, but I can tell you that it's measured anywhere from months of time to literally items that are reported on a weekly basis. And in the details, we have a schedule of about 5,000 individual trackable items that we were reporting on a weekly basis up until a couple of weeks ago. And that's the level of oversight that we have. I can also say that up until this point, the team has met every single program milestone over the first 2.5, almost 3 years of the program, and it's something I'm extremely also proud of. But this is a framework for bringing together people from all the different disciplines and looking at, okay, some places the discovery is still going on while the engineering development is proceeding. And so we have to look at any particular point where it's possible to actually pick up the research and apply it. And there are certain windows of opportunity to take advantage of that. And sometimes you have to move on and accept that the discovery process hasn't matured fast enough to make that a practical solution. The cultural divide here, I would say, is between, you know, academic researchers and, you know, sort of engineering practitioners. It's also, again, as I mentioned, between people of different disciplines or people from different sort of ethnic cultures to some degree. But that's just something that has to be taken into consideration into the model. So to frame the next couple of slides, I want to show you some video of Jesse Sullivan. Jesse is one of our collaborating partners, who is an electrical lineman that lost both of his limbs in an electrical accident at the age of 55. And so Jesse's trying one of our first prototypes here, and the movements that he's making, he's actually doing this within the first 2 to 3 hours of use time of this limb, in the first couple of days that we were working with him. In the background, you see a virtual model that's tracking what Jesse's doing with his limb here. And you can see that, yes, it does go all the way around. That draws everyone's attention in. But that's something that originally we didn't plan for that in the mechanical design. We planned on having the normal range of motions of our native limb. But Jesse really liked that capability, and so we actually did then go ahead and make the provisions for it to do that so he could do some other tasks that enjoys doing. I think it helps a lot with winding a fishing reel, which we'll talk about some other time. But this to get to this point, which actually happened about 9 months from the start of the program, and it was really a forcing function to bring the team together. To force, for example, Jesse had already had a surgical process that enabled what's called targeted motor reinnervation that allowed the remapping of the peripheral nerves that would have went down his arm to this area up on his chest that you see. And then we were able to work with people that have been working on signal processing and pattern recognition algorithms to actually integrate those into a limb system and put this all together so we got to the clinical experience very early on. That really helped from the standpoint of showing the team that we could function as a unit, and also we learned an awful lot from Jesse about what the next generation of limbs with improved dexterity really should do in order to be useful for the individual and further reinforce the vision of the program and the ultimate goal. So this, in the background, this computer model, this virtual integration environment, is actually part of breaking down the geographical barrier across all these different performers. And so there are a number of other online collaborative tools like Meeting Place or SharePoint where we exchange files and track design revisions so everybody stays current with the latest models that they're interacting with on any aspect of the program. But this really allows us to synchronize some of the research and design efforts. And so partners all across the program have one of these virtual integration systems and is connected via internet. And so we don't have the full sort of broadband infrastructure that you'll hear about later this afternoon that has been going on in partnership between the research activities here in Canada and other parts of the U.S. But it's a common platform that really facilitates breaking down the distance gap. And so I think to a large degree that issue is becoming where people can work, you know, at home. And in fact, I have one PI who was in Chicago, and I was at a meeting at the University of Brunswick with him. And as we were going back home, he went to a different gate than I expected him to go to in the airport. I said, "Richard, where are you going?" He said, "Oh, I guess I haven't told you this, but he had moved from Chicago to Boulder, Colorado, and had been working remotely from his lab for about 2.5 months, and I hadn't picked up on it." And so he convinced his dean that that was an acceptable move because primarily he was working via these remote systems anyways. So I think that model in terms of geographical separation is something that we've overcome and that the people in this room are continuing to overcome it in novel ways that will continue to facilitate people working together more closely. I think there's also a compelling need to show what's beyond the initial goals of bringing this team together. If there's a way of sustaining at least a portion of the momentum from the group. Now, certainly, you can't. It's not cost effective, nor is it even necessarily organizationally effective to maintain all of these connections for a long period of time. But there are a lot of synergies that come out of them that lead to new applications and new opportunities that wouldn't have existed with the individual bodies alone. And I think that's an important message. Some examples of that: if you take our prosthetic limb program and our kind of applied neuroscience progress. We're developing, and this is one of our programs, where we have a two-armed dexterous robotic system that you can actually wear a instrumented suit that allows you to project sort of your own natural human movements and dexterity into some remote place. So the idea there is, could we keep people who are diffusing and improvised explosive devices or dealing with a hazardous environment out of harm's way in the first place? You know, so I have the opportunity to put my entire prosthetics business out of work. Well, not really, but I can't help with civilian accidents and all that. But if we could keep some number of people from being injured by applying the technology in a different way, that's a very, very worthwhile goal. And that's so just to give you an idea, that requires actually integrating, you know, novel control systems to deal with the balancing of the platform, moving towards a bipedal vision of the future, looking at compliance so that these devices can manipulate door handles and do things that a human do, because robots and mobile robotic systems are really functioning in a world that was developed by humans with you know, those kinds of issues and debris and other kinds of objects that are in the path. So there are a range of, as you can imagine, visual and other kinds of integrated technologies that need to be part of these next generation, I think, of, you know, cross-disciplinary challenges. And so just to kind of return to what I stated in the beginning was, you know, my goal of getting a few points across is that in this example, I think you can see that people working on maybe the neuroscience implants can be working in a unidisciplinary method in a research environment for most of their work. We have to look at how you get the data out of those implants, how you decode and process that, how you communicate it back to the user through the mechanical system, and that requires them to, at some point, to at least enter this multidisciplinary mode and maybe to begin to think about how those signals actually are used in a way that forces more of the transdisciplinary work that will be discussed in detail later. And then I think both of these sort of program areas that I pointed out have the components of, you know, they're professionally compelling. People understand that they're making an impact by developing these new systems and actually giving people a restored ability to function and have an improved quality of life. And I think they continue to be compelling because they have applications beyond the initial piece. Now, I wanted to end by thinking of another problem or an example of where transdisciplinary or cross-disciplinary practice came to bear in some practical outcome. And so I looked really hard in the newspapers and in the media to find an example of positive news. You know, I don't know if anybody's read the newspapers about the U.S. economy, but in the context of looking for an article, I will have to say that the most positive thing I could find was a plane crash. And so you may think this is in bad taste, but it's actually, I think, an example where there was no one injured, right? And so you know about the U.S. Airways flight that landed in the Hudson River, right? And so you think about this for a minute. Okay, this was largely a stroke of, you know, calmness and professionalism on the part of the pilot, but it also was, to a large extent, luck, right? I mean, you had, by the capability to actually land where they did in the Hudson, you had the response from the different port authority boats and the fire department boats, police department boats, in a very quick period of time to evacuate people from the plane without any injuries, okay? Or any significant injuries, I should say. So that broke down the communication barriers between these different agencies that have that people in the Department of Homeland Security have spent the last several years trying to break down through a bureaucratic process instantly, out of necessity, out of compelling vision, and out of need. Okay. And I think it's a very good story and something to think about as we talk about, you know, people working together that come from all different backgrounds to a common goal as a snapshot of what can be accomplished. But I think it also, as someone, one of my colleagues who sent me this pointed out, it also indicates that there are still differences between cultures and between classes that not necessarily completely mitigated by technology or driving vision. And not necessarily a bad thing, but just have to be considered. So, all right, I'll leave it at that, and I'll be happy to entertain questions during the break. So thanks very much for the time.